Now, one of the things that happens with the lower, first of all, when you're pumping more money into the system, there's a lot of money around. All right, so there's money to lend out. The banks have more money to lend out. And secondly, if you're lower interest rates in the United States, you're making foreign lending more attractive. So if the interest rate is only 3% in the United States, you can get 10% in Bulgaria. You might be stimulated to start lending money to Bulgaria. So one of the things that happens then is the stimulation of a massive private foreign lending program by American banks and American citizens abroad. Banks were involved as export underwriters, as lenders, you know, underwriters, commissions on loans, etc. The foreign lending system worked something like the sort of like a private version of the governmental foreign aid after World War II. There weren't too many U.S. government loans to Europe in the 1920s, but there were a lot of private loans on this basis. There were a lot of loans to German municipalities, for example. So every German city and township could build big, you know, big city halls and sort of thing, statues or whatever their statues were. So there was an enormous amount of malinvestment in this whole thing. Peculiar thing here is this. The United States wants to stimulate our American exports. There are two ways in which the American export industry can be successful, so to speak. One is to have low tariffs so that we can sell machinery, automobiles, and whatever abroad, and then they can sell whatever, you know, food or whatever to us, or Swiss clocks or whatever to us. If we have low tariffs, this permits this interchange, and our imports can then pay for our exports. But we didn't want that. We wanted a high tariff. Republican policy has always been high tariff, so because we also want to protect the domestic industries from their more efficient competitors abroad. So how can we do this? How can we stimulate American exports and still protect, you know, domestic industries by keeping out American imports? This is the old mercantilist bag, of course. We're back now. We haven't learned anything in the sense since 1650 or whatever. So how are we going to do this? Well, one way of doing it, obviously it can't last forever, but one way of doing it is to lend them the money. Keep the European goods out, and then lend the Europeans the money to buy our products, buy our exports. It sounds kind of crazy, but the point is, look at who's benefiting from it. The domestic industries are benefiting from the tariff protection, and the export industries are benefiting from the fact that all the money is rooting back, going from the American investor back to the English or Bulgarian or whatever importer, and then back to the American exporter. Now, of course, we've changed that. We have the American taxpayer fueling the whole thing because it's more permanent kind of process. So this is obviously a kind of shaky system. I mean, it rests on continuing to keep lending money, you know, keep one step ahead of retribution in a sense. Because somehow, the foreign countries are going to have to earn dollars in some way in order to pay for these exports. I mean, you know, it's impossible to think of these loans going on forever. I mean, loans are also supposedly based on repayment, how the Europeans are going to repay the loans if they can't earn any dollars by exporting products to the United States. Okay, so we have this other peculiar system then. We have high U.S. tariff wall, and we have foreign loans to allow the Europeans to buy our exports. The farmers, of course, want a stimulation. The farmers are exporters, the export industry. They were very happy with this whole thing. And Benjamin Strong was trying to rationalize this policy to the masses. He didn't say we have to help England. He said we have to keep up farm prices. And this, of course, everybody said, very, very ha-cha. And this was the sort of the public face of the thing. The farmers wanted us to, you know, the farmers is, it's a really peculiar thing. I don't want to get too much into the farm program again, but it's kind of peculiar. The farmers look back to the parity thing, an average of 1909 or 1910 to 1914, when the farmers, because of the impending war in Europe, the farmers are the highest proportionate farm price per other price in the history of the country. And this is the golden age. They're looking at everything since then and trying to get back to force all of us to wrench ourselves back into this 1909, 1914 kind of setup. Okay, the first great boom in foreign lending begins with the Federal Reserve inflation of late 21, early 22, and then it's stimulated, and it falls back again, and then it's stimulated once more by this 24 inflation that I mentioned. And it's also this foreign lending, by the way, was helped along by what's called in the sources a deluge of U.S. government and banking propaganda, enormous amount of propaganda beamed to the public about, quote, the economic necessity to the United States of foreign lending. It's a peculiar thing, by the way. I haven't got, again, time to go into this, but there arises in the late 19th century among the theoreticians, a small knot of apocalyptic theoreticians around Teddy Roosevelt, Brooks Adams and Henry Adams and Captain Mann and so forth, sort of Leninism in reverse. Here are the guys that come to the conclusion that capitalism is sunk unless you have foreign markets, unless you can, because there's enormous surplus piling up, and we can't buy the surplus. We have to open up the other countries by any means necessary, to use the current phraseology, and force them to take our products. Otherwise, capitalism is doomed. This is Lenin's interpretation from the other side. The only difference is these guys say, therefore, we have to go in and smash everybody and force them to buy our exports. And what happened, and they keep saying this all the time, and a lot of, presumably some of these people believe it, and William Appleman Williams and his students look at this situation and think that this reflects the reality. In other words, they think that the Lenin-Brooks-Adams analysis is correct, and therefore the capitalism has, in order to sustain itself, has to keep it being imperialistic and forcing everybody to buy our products, etc. So this, I think, is a completely faulty analysis situation. Obviously, some exporters would like to have other, to force the government have to force other people to buy their products. That's a very different thing than saying that capitalism, the health of the capitalist system, requires this. Because there always have been, of course, businessmen looking for special privileges as against their competitors, against the consumer, and so forth. It's a very different kind of, obviously, analysis. Okay, so this resumption of U.S. inflation in 24 picks the foreign lending boom up, and it carries on in a mighty foreign lending boom in the United States to foreign countries until 1928. In the meantime, while this is going on, Herbert Hoover, the Department of Commerce, is trying to stimulate exports in all sorts of other ways, trying to get export cartels and stimulating foreign loans and so forth. As a matter of fact, Hoover is so enthusiastic about foreign lending that he says that even bad loans are really good, even if the loan will be defaulted eventually because they help exports. Interesting analysis. And yet, you know, while this was going on, of course, Norman is griping privately. I mean, publicly, the British are falling all over Benjamin Strong and saying he's the greatest guy in the history of the world, and so on and so on. In private, Norman's constantly griping about Strong isn't doing enough. Why isn't he inflating more? Why isn't he, he's being ungrateful, and so forth. For example, by 1919, even as early as 1919, Basil Blackett was urging Strong to let the United States prices rise a little more. Here we are in a fantastic boom, 1919-20, prices skyrocketing. And Blackett is complaining, he says, you know, keep prices going up. And Norman is constantly pressing throughout, almost continually in this whole thing. Finally, in 1924, of course, Norman is very happy and Strong has this big inflationary push. And he writes to Strong and he says, you must continue with easy money and foreign loans. It's great, you know, great, hooray. But privately, he's still right that the United States wasn't inflating enough. Should still be doing more. Okay, but then, I see, it's really giving like an injection to a horse. You dope the horse runs a lot, and then, you know, after a while it collapses. So we have this inflationary injection, and everything's inflating, and the interest rates are down. But then what happens? This has been a couple of years. By 1926, 27, American prices start falling again, and interest rates are going up, and Britain is in trouble again. Britain is, of course, continuous inflationary cheap money policy. By this time, Britain has gone back to the gold standards. They're even worse off than they were in the early 20s. Heavy unemployment and export industries and so forth. And British gold is falling into the United States. And Britain insists on keeping their interest rate low. They don't take the classical 19th century method of raising interest rates in order to keep gold from going up. They have to keep this inflationary policy. That's a given. So what can they do about it? Well, they have to pressure us for another big dose. We dope the horse once more. Another big dose of American inflation. Notice how short run this whole thing is. And nobody really. I think I may have mentioned this before, but it bears repeating. In the textbooks, they always say private people are narrow minded. They're only looking for the next couple of years or whatever. It's the government that's far sighted. The government that sees clearly plans for 100 years in the future. You know, plans for the whole human race. Actually, nobody is shorter range than the government. The government, they're babying everything along with the next election to the fall, get past this crisis, get past that, you know, as long as they're in office. And they don't really care what happens in 5 or 10 years. And it's obvious with this thing, nobody looks ahead and says, well, what happened? You can't keep doing this indefinitely. know, just baby along another 6 months, another 3 months. I mean, okay, we'll be out of office then or whatever. The world, you know, the world might explode and the Martians might come back or whatever. By the time retribution, you know, catches up with us. And Britain is, and Benjamin Strong is buying sterling to try to keep the pound rate up. Once again, the time has come for another big dose of inflation. And as Benjamin Strong tells Charles Reese, who is a brilliant French economist and very much opposed to this whole thing, saw what was going on. But he represented the Bank of France in this situation. They have a four-man conference, big four central bank conference in New York. Again, secret, of course. Nobody's supposed to know about it. In July 1927, consisting of Norman, Strong, Reist, and Hjalmar Schacht, who was the head of the German Reichsbank. And the idea was that Norman and Strong had agreed what was going to happen beforehand. They were trying to induce the other two guys to go along with a big inflationary push. And Strong gaily tells Reist, I'm going to give a little coup de whiskey to the stock market. A little coup de whiskey, that was a very, very nice phrase there. So Schacht was a sort of sound money type. Schacht and Reese was very sort of semi-Austrian. He's really something like Willis and Anderson's home analysis. Reese was horrified, and Schacht was horrified, and they go home very quickly. And Norman and Strong carry this forward. They're disappointed that Schacht and Reese don't want to inflate together, because it'd be nice if everybody can inflate at once. You solve a lot of the problems of losing gold to other countries. But anyway, so that's too bad. And so they held this. I really don't know if this has any significance or not, but I toss it out to future historians to look into it, perhaps. The secret conference was held at the Long Island estate of Ogden Mills and Mrs. Ruth Pratt of the Standard Oil Pratt family. Whether that has any significance, whether they just had an empty house available, I don't know. At any rate, so Norman and Strong agree they're gonna keep buying gold. They're gonna have another mighty dose of inflation in the United States. They're going to expand credit once again, raise prices again, and lower American interest rates. So Strong does this. We have another massive purchase by the Federal Reserve of government securities in the open market. This was the biggest single inflationary dose of the 1920s, this 1927 dose. The British press was delighted. They were falling all over themselves. Fantastic thing. The London magazine, The Banker, had already said after the 1924 thing, They already had written that Benjamin Strong wrote about Benjamin Strong, quote, no better friend of England has existed, and praised, quote, the energy and skillfulness that he's given to the service of England. Interesting. This is sort of thing that sent Colonel McCormick up the wall. And also went on to say, this is the English magazine, The Banker, that Strong's name should be associated with that of Mr. Page as a friend of England in her greatest need. Walter Hines Page, of course, the American ambassador to England, whom Mencken, I think, justly referred to as Anglo-maniacal in his intensity of getting us into the war. A leading American banker admitted to Ben Anderson in late 1926 that this cheap money policy, which Strong was putting into effect, would have very bad American consequences in the United States. But he said, quote, that cannot be helped. It is the price we must pay for helping Europe, unquote. One of the problems is that this banker, you know, had decided that we would have to pay the price, but the rest of us weren't consulted about this. The unemployed and so forth, the guys are going to starve during the Depression. We're not consulted on this, you know, this decision. That's the use of the word we, which is always a key thing in social philosophy. It's like the famous Keynesian phrase, the public debt doesn't mean anything, because we owe it to ourselves. Of course, the big question there, who's the we and who's the ourselves? Well, there are different sets of people. okay, so this 1927 push was the largest single rate of increase in bank reserves in the 20s. And Herbert Hoover was critical from 1924 on of this whole thing. He was very critical of the stock market boom. And this would lead again to, you know, sort of a Hoover-Rockefeller thing. Hoover was critical of the inflationary aspect of the whole thing. He called Benjamin Strong, quote, a mental annex to Europe, unquote. but Coolidge and Mellon were very much in favor of this. Coolidge, incidentally, did not really schnooze his way through the White House. I wish he had. Every once in a while, he'd wake up and he'd endorse the Strong policy. But another thing he'd do, he'd wake up and he'd call for increases in the stock market. There's a great article, I think, in sometime in 1928 in the Atlantic Monthly by Ralph Robey, who was a student of Benjamin Beckhardt, who was a student of H. Parker Willis. I guess he was a student of Willis himself. He wrote a great article in the Atlantic Monthly entitled The Capiadores of Wall Street, and he referring to Coolidge and Mellon, because every time the stock market would flag a little bit, Coolidge and Mellon would rush into the print and make statements like, you know, the stock market is getting too low again, we have to, it should be higher, and the America's in great shape, and, you know, keep buying stock and that sort of stuff, and I will buy stock at this level. And all sorts of statements designed to try to boost the stock market every time it showed signs of relaxing a little bit. There's a private memorandum written about in 1928 by an assistant, an age is strong, written to an English banker, a very prominent banker, Sir Ace Alexander Salter. And he's trying to explain why Strong couldn't have an open formal conference, you know, with all the central banks and have it, you know, openly in Washington and New York and have a big publicity about it and have a formal Bretton Woods kind of arrangement. And why you need this secrecy. And he says Strong has to, quote, consider the viewpoint of the American public. And therefore keep it secret. And because the American public has this prejudice against the League of Nations, against us interfering in other people's affairs, and they're interfering in our affairs, and it's very, you know, very hampering, the whole thing. And he says, to illustrate how inflamed public or political opinion might easily become when the results of past decisions become evident, he cites the outcry against certain specific excesses in the stock market. He says, here it is, you know, people are bellyaching with this big stock boom. And that's why we have to keep the thing secret. I like that phrase, how inflamed public opinion might easily become when the results of past decisions become evident. You know, that's a really striking phrase. It means when somebody makes a secret decision to get into Vietnam or something, and 5 years the results become evident, then the public might become inflamed about it. That's why we have to keep the decision secret. Strong said that, the very few people indeed realized that we were now paying the penalty for the decision which was reached early in 1924. This is 1928. Decision reached early in 1924 to help the rest of the world back to a sound financial and monetary basis. Why? Because the reason why they didn't realize, nobody told them either about the original decision or about what's going to happen when the original decision goes into effect. In short, if the American people were allowed to know what had been transacted in their name and the ensuing penalties they were forced to pay because of these decisions, they would rise up in their wrath. That's presumably what Strong is saying. Okay, after the 1927 coup de whiskey, the New York Fed in 1927 through 1929 bought very heavily in foreign commercial bills to try to stem any gold flow from Europe and to give the Europeans, again, more money to buy our exports. We bought sterling bills very heavily. The idea that we'd have to keep buying sterling bills to keep the sterling, keep gold flowing back to Britain and prop the sterling up. Because sterling is very weak shape here. Obviously, the dollar, the pound is very heavily overvalued. And the French are piling up sterling balances. The British are pleading with them, don't try to redeem in gold. We're going to wreck the system and so forth. Again, this inflationary thing has a temporary success in 27, 28. Gold flows out again. Foreign prices go up. The pound strengthens a little bit, exports rise, and so forth. British exports rise, and so forth. And foreign loans are stimulated to new heights, being reached in mid-1928. But by mid-1928, the coup de whiskey, you know, the whiskey, right, you know, disappears from the system of the British horse, so to speak. And the pound starts sagging again, and exports fall, farm prices fall, foreign loans are slumping. And for one reason why foreign loans are slumping, this is kind of ironic, as the stock market begins to really take off into the stratosphere, everybody says, why should we lend money to foreigners? We're going to invest in the stock market. That's what we're really getting there. We're tripling our money every week or whatever. So foreign loans begin drying up. And President Coolidge continues his Capiador role till the very last day that he leaves office in March 1929. Coolidge says the U.S. prosperity is absolutely sound, and stocks are, quote, cheap at current prices, unquote. Really, you know, his is a way, has reached lunar proportions up there. And One interesting thing is, which I'm sure Forrest would be interested in particularly, is that one of the leading bull market speculators in this period, in the late 1920s, was William C. Durant, who was one of the early General Motors people who was kicked out by Sloan and DuPont when they reorganized General Motors, now found his niche in the crash, I mean, found a niche in the stock market. And he was constantly praising Coolidge and Mellon for cheap money and for their statements and boosting the stock market. He collapsed during the crash. Social Darwinism came to William C. Durant. So the stock market crash. Finally, the way this thing really stops is that Benjamin, as Harry Elmer Barnes wrote in a letter about somebody else, finally, God snatched Benjamin Strong, and he died in late 1928. And then this sort of ended really the big inflationary push. His assistants start trying to continue on the same thing. They didn't have the charisma of Strong, and the control of the Federal Reserve System shifts back to Washington, and they stumble around in very sort of confused fashion. And by early 1929, they're no longer increasing the money supply. Money supply continues level, which means this process, this big money inflation stops, and when money inflation stops, the recession begins, as Austrian theory, even Friedmanite theory predicts. And so the crash, really the industrial economy turns down around mid-1929, June or July. Industrial production began to fall. The stock market, of course, has its big collapse in October. There were three basic means by which the Federal Reserve System inflated in the 20s, all of them fairly new, really brand new to the 20s, great new breakthroughs in monetary policy. One was the open market purchases, which I already mentioned. Two was the rediscount rate. Rediscount rate is not as important as open market purchases, but it has a certain role. Remember Walter Badgett in the mid-19th century in Britain had defined the key role of the central bank is to always be a lender of last resort, to bail out any bank that is overexpanded and in the danger of collapse. Well, the idea, though, the classical 19th century bailer-out, lender of last resort theory, was that the central bank should keep its rediscount rate, in other words, the rate at which it lends money to the banks, at a so-called penalty level, in other words, higher than the market. So if the bank can lend money out at 8%, let's say, and if it gets into trouble, the central bank rate should be higher than 8%, should be, let's say, 10%, which is a penalty which penalizes the banks and induces them to get into a sound position and get out of debt as quickly as possible. So the classical theory of central bank rediscounting was a penalty rate. In the early 1920s, Strong and the Federal Reserve changed this whole policy and keep the Federal Reserve rate below the market, below everything else. Instead of having it 10%, you have it down to 6 or 5, 4, whatever the thing is. This, of course, stimulates bank lending. And this increases bank reserves and pairing your pyramid on top of that, and so forth. So this is an extremely inflationary kind of thing. Fortunately, the banks usually don't like to be in debt to the Federal Reserve, so this dislike tends to limit the use of this, but it's still important nevertheless. The idea, again, was to make credit, quote, more elastic, unquote. here, in connection with this, I have a statement reminiscing by Secretary of Treasury William Gibbs McAdoo about the purpose of the establishment of the Federal Reserve System. He says, quote, "The primary purpose of the Federal Reserve Act was to alter and strengthen our banking system that the enlarged credit resources demanded by the needs of business and agriculture will come almost automatically into existence and at rates of interest low enough to stimulate, protect, and prosper all kinds of legitimate business." They're really saying it's for inflationary purposes, for cheap credit. Okay, so another thing is to keep the discount rate below the market instead of above it. And the third thing is a very peculiar thing, which I already alluded to, the acceptance capers, the grand acceptance capers. It's really almost bizarre. I don't want to go into it in great detail. The point is that American credit, the American business system, had always been a so-called single-name, rest on so-called single-name credit. I lend money from Bill Beach. I write out an IOU, and Bill Beach keeps it, and then he calls upon redemption in 3 months or whatever. In Europe, on the other hand, the so-called acceptance system had become the developed system, where you have acceptance dealers, acceptance banks, which endorse this paper, and then call upon the debtor for redemption. So Federal Reserve after World War I embarks on the peculiar policy of trying to create in the United States a whole new acceptance market. And obviously this is connected with foreign trade, the fact that this will ease the, you know, the idea of buying and selling abroad, and especially lending money abroad, because acceptances were only used in Europe. But the way they did it, the way the Federal Reserve did it, they announced they stood ready to buy all acceptances that would be offered to it, irregardless. all acceptances that are offered to it at a very cheap rate, in other words, a heavily subsidized rate. So every time, in 1928, for example, the Fed begins to get a little scared and tries to restrict credit, tries to hold back on buying open market purchases, then the market turns to acceptances, and they start generating acceptances, and they force the Fed to buy them at a cheap rate. And this gives reserves, more reserves to the banks. Forced because the Fed has announced as one of their great givens that we will buy all acceptances offered to us at a cheap rate. But there's another interesting thing about this acceptance policy. The Federal Reserve said they would only buy acceptances from acceptance banks and not directly from the banks. They would only buy them from the acceptance dealer, acceptance houses, and they would only buy from acceptance houses that are very large. They're worth more than $1 million capitalization. So this restricts the whole thing to a few pet acceptance houses. And of course, this gives a lot of moolah to the pet acceptance, to these few special acceptance houses. Now, as I try to indicate, so most historians dealing with this policy can't understand, why does the Fed do this? It's crazy. They're tying their own hands in there. And why are they trying to generate a whole acceptance market that doesn't exist, and subsidizing a market that doesn't exist, so forth and so on. And really, only a certain dose of conspiracy analysis can explain this whole thing as anything other than pure irrationality on the part of the Fed. As I mentioned, Paul Warburg, one of the great founders of the Federal Reserve System, one of the guys who wrote the Jekyll Island Plan, one of the head of the Federal Advisory Council of the Federal Reserve System, and a member of the Federal Reserve Board, was also one of the world's top acceptance bankers. He was the chairman of the board of International Acceptance Corporation, a couple of others. He became president of the Trade Association of Acceptance Dealers, and he boasted before, as president, in his presidential address to the acceptance dealers, that he was the one who induced Benjamin Strong to establish this policy of subsidizing, all-out permanent subsidy, you know, acceptance price support, so to speak, or foreign price support, in the acceptance market. After 1929, the whole acceptance thing disappears. They don't try to do this anymore, but the damage was done in that sense. Okay. Irving, meanwhile, all this was going on, Strong had his theoretician. In addition to having Morgan as his practical guide, he had his theoretical arm in Irving Fisher. And the idea of the so-called Stable Money League or Stable Money Association, which in various forms Fisher had been pushing since approximately 1908 or something like that. 1911. Again, the idea was that Fisher, since the business cycle is simply a dance of the dollar, all you have to do is for the government to stabilize the price level. Pump money in when the prices are falling, take money out when the prices are rising, have a stable price level. This will end the world problems, business cycle problems. This was called stable money, and the guys who were against inflation were called the sound money people. This is the sound versus stable. The Austrian view, and also the Willis Anderson view, was that this is going to mask a bad situation which is occurring. Because first of all, in the free market, as I mentioned before, when productivity increases, prices are supposed to be falling, price level is supposed to be going down. And if you deliberately inflate bank credit, even if to stop prices from going down, even if the price level is stable, which it was basically in the 1920s, the wholesale price level was stable. But still in all, what's going on here is this whole process of overinflating in the capital goods industry, the expense of the consumer goods industry is still occurring. Even though prices don't go up, prices are higher than they would have been without this inflationary credit expansion. So Mises in Austria and Willis and Anderson in the United States and Robbins in England, etc., are constantly saying, you've got to have a depression, you've got to watch out, This thing is going to collapse. And Fisher kept saying, no, no, wholesale prices are constant, there's no problem. One thing about these price stabilizationists, when push comes to shove, they're always in favor of stabilizing. They're usually only in favor of stabilizing when there's a danger of prices falling. When prices are rising, you don't hear from them. They're out of town. they lose their enthusiasm for stable money. So really, price stabilization is another subtle form of price increase. Well, Fisher, as I say, begins. He is. If the capital market is overexpanded, this means that the stock market, something's happening to stocks and land and so forth. I mean, overinflated, really. Irving Fisher was heavily invested in the stock market himself, using his wife Carolyn, his wife's sisters, Carolyn Hazard's millions, and had plunged in a big way here in the stock market. And he kept urging more credit expansion and higher stock prices. During the boom of the 20s, he kept saying, no, there's no problem. Price level is constant. Pump more money in the stock market. And during the recession, of course, he went ape. I mean, he was calling for reflation. Instead of saying, okay. Now, it's funny, the price stabilization people, they could have said, when prices fell sharply from 29 to 33, they could have said, let's stabilize at the current level. I mean, the government should prevent prices from falling any further. They didn't say that. It became what was called then reflationists. It called for pushing the price level back up to 1929 and then stabilizing it to the 29 level, which doesn't make any sense really even within the Fisher category of stabilizing the price level. Because you're in favor of a stable price level, you're really saying you don't really care where the price level is. Just stabilize it wherever it is. And they say that during the 20s when the price level was stable, but bingo, you suddenly get the 1929-33 period, the prices have fallen a lot, they're calling for pushing it. No, don't stabilize now. Push the prices up back to 29 and then stabilize. Which shows they're really blankety-blank inflationists rather than stable, under the mask of stabilization. Okay, so... you couldn't imagine the number of big shots who were in the stable money movement. Now, it's true, many of them could have just signed their name. You know, Fisher might have been a pest, I really don't know. And yeah, and all these guys said, you know, all right, I'll sign this. It sounds theoretical enough not to be dangerous. So I'll concede that. But still, I think there's something involved here. The fact that so many corporate liberal big shots were involved in this price stabilization movement. Who were some of these people? Well, for example, it was J.M. Keynes, who was cheering it from England, who was involved in this from the very beginning in this whole thing. There was our good friend, our old and good friend, John R. Cummins, who was very big in the stable price level movement. There was President William Howard Taft, who was extremely enthusiastic about it. Also, Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, another brilliant monetary theorist. And Governor Woodrow Wilson, when he was governor and later president. All these guys signed up as part of the Stable Money League, or Stable Money Association, I forget what he called it then. There were several names to this. Also involved was Gifford Pinchot, the famous progressive conservationist. Assistant Secretary of State Huntington Wilson, Secretary of War Newton D. Baker under the Wilson administration, Professor James Harvey Rogers of Cornell was very, very big in the stabilization movement, Wesley C. Mitchell of the National Bureau of Economic Research was big in World War I planning, John E. Rovinsky of the Bank of America, Jeremiah W. Jenks, and I already mentioned the Economist Financial Civic Federation, Henry A. Wallace, heavily involved in this. Also, John C. Wynant, who was a beloved figure apparently in this. There's several pages in E. Digby Boltzell's great book, The Protestant Establishment, which deals with the greatness of John C. Wynant, the belovedness of John C. Wynant throughout this whole corporate. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Also, George Eastman of Eastman Kodak, I've already said, was heavily involved in progressive reform in Rochester. Samuel Gompers, naturally. John W. Davis, a Morgan lawyer, was ran for the Democratic nomination for president in 1924. Charles Dawes, who was vice president in the Republican administration. William Green of the American Federation of Labor. Otto Kahn, investment banker. Elihu Root. James H. Rand, Jr., Remington Rand. Frederick C. Delano, who was... Faculty Roosevelt's uncle, Westbrook Peckler, always used to refer to as Uncle Delano. Paul M. Warburg, Owen D. Young of General Electric, and the presidents, and also Norman Thomas, the final What's final on Yuppie? It's only several people here have complained and they don't know what is this Von Yuppie thing? And Lon Yuppie is an Italian word. L-A-G-N-I-A-P-P-E, which essentially means the icing on the cake, you know, the final cherry on the birthday cake or something. So, or adding insult to injury, the insult that's added to injury or whatever. There's a final Lon Yuppie in this whole thing. Norman Thomas was also involved in this with all the other, was all the spiritual colleagues that I mentioned up till now. And in addition, all these people, and Max Lazar of Lazar Frere in France, and Louis Rothschild, the great Rothschild banking family in Europe, also were involved in this. And the presidents of all the following associations were members of the Stable Money League and Stable Money Association: the American Association of Labor Legislation, which I mentioned already, the American Bar Association, the American Farm Bureau Federation, the Brotherhood of Railroad Train Men, 43 chairman of the state, chairman of 43 state bankers associations, the National Assembly of Credit Men, the National Education Association, this brings in our progressive educationists in the picture, the United Mine Workers, the National Grange, the Merchants Association of New York, and the Chicago Association of Commerce. Also very big, and this is Frank Vanderlip of the National City Bank. And two big theoreticians for this, who become important because they're Hoover's big theoreticians in the late 20s, was the famous inflationary economic writing team of Forster and Catchings. Forster and Catchings wrote various inflationist works in the 20s in favor of public works to stabilize recessions, etc. This team is rather interesting. Forster was a theoretician. He's the guy who had this, who put out all this stuff about the giving X amount of dollars to each guy, etc. And Catchings, they formed the Pollack Foundation for Economic Research, I think it's called. And Waddell Catchings was more interesting than Forster in a sense. He was when he was a partner of Goldman and Sachs investment banking company, he's also a iron and steel magnate who got heavily involved in inflationary theory. And then the two of them formed this alliance. Just as a statistic here, the total money supply from June 30th, 1921 to June 30th, 1929, during these eight inflationary years, increased by approximately 62% over this eight-year period, including a broad, defining money in a very broad sense of anything, either bank deposits or demand deposits or anything in, redeemable at par in bank deposits, and which is an average annual increase of something less than 8%. During, as I say, the first half of 1929, the money supply stops increasing and the whole thing collapses. Okay, what I'm going to do now, I was going to, rearranging things a bit, I'm going to press on with the monetary picture, at least during the early New Deal, I think I'm going to drop Hoover, because I think you all know what I have to say about Hoover, since it's in the readings. I'll press on. So there's a certain undercurrent here in this conference which wants to have, which is calling for two more weeks of conference. Barring that taking place, I'll cut a bit here and go on to the domestic 30s. Okay, I have a thing here which is written. First, I began, this is a paper I delivered other places, not yet published. And I begin by sort of summing up the 20s as a background, things I've been saying, and then press on to the 30s. Anything missing here? Okay. So let's see about this. I'll start reading this and see what happens. The international monetary framework of the 1920s collapsed in the storm of the Great Depression, or rather a collapse of its own inner contradictions in a depression which it had helped to bring about. For one of the most calamitous features of the depression was the international wave of banking failures, and the banks failed from the inflation and overexpansion which were the fruits of the managed international gold exchange standard. Once the jerry-built pyramiding of bank credit had collapsed, it brought down the banking system of nation after nation. As inflation led to a piling up of currency claims abroad, the cashing in of the claims led to well-founded suspicion of the solvency of other banks, and so the failures spread and intensified. The failures in the weak currency countries led to the accumulation of strains in other weak currency nations, and ultimately on the bases of the shaky pyramid, Britain and the United States. The major banking crisis began with a near bankruptcy in 1929 of the Bodenkredit Anstalt of Vienna, the major bank in Austria, which had never recovered from its dismemberment at Versailles. Desperate attempts by J.P. Morgan, the House of Rothschild, and later the New York Fed to shore up the bank only succeeded in a temporary rescue, which committed more financial resources to an unsound bank and thereby made its ultimate failure in May 1931 all the more catastrophic. Rather than permit the outright liquidation of their banking systems, Austria, followed by Germany and other European countries, went off the gold standard during 1931. So they were really faced as we were faced in 1933. Because we had, in 1933, we had a glorious opportunity to wipe out the entire banking system. I mean, it was being wiped out. Those of us who were, in contrast to Forrest, who are ardent Jacksonian types, saw the great vision, or would have seen if I were around in 1933, if I were an economist then, would have seen this fantastic opportunity. I mean, the entire banking system was toppling. We could have gone over to very sound, non-fractional reserve money very easily then. At any rate, so faced with this choice, they all opt out and they go off the gold standard. But the key to the international monetary situation was Great Britain, the nub and the base for the world's gold exchange standard. British inflation and cheap money, and the standard which had made Britain the base of the world's money, put enormous pressure on the pound sterling as foreign holders of sterling balances became increasingly panicky and called on the British to redeem their sterling in either gold or dollars. And the French, what happened was the French precipitated things. The French finally decided we've had it and started cashing in their sterling. The heavy loans by British banks to Germany during the 1920s made the pressure after the German monetary collapse still more severe. But Britain could have saved the day by using the classical gold standard medicine in such crisis, by raising bank interest rates sharply, thereby attracting funds to Britain from other countries. In such monetary crises, furthermore, such temporary tight money and checks to inflation gives foreigners confidence that the pound will be sustained, and they then continue to hold sterling without calling on the country for redemption. In earlier crises, for example, Britain had raised its bank rate, the bank rate meaning the banks, Bank of England's rediscount rate, basically, to the other banks, had raised its bank rate as high as 10% early in the proceedings, and temporarily contracted the money supply to put a stringent check to inflation. But by 1931, deflation and hard money had become unthinkable in the British political climate. And so Britain stunned the financial world by keeping its bank rate very low, never raising it above 4.5%, and in fact continued to inflate sterling still further to offset gold losses abroad. As the run on sterling inevitably intensified, Great Britain cynically repudiated its own gold exchange standard, the very monetary standard that had forced and cajoled Europe to adopt by coolly going off the gold standard on September 1931, saying, well, tough fellas, we ain't playing this game anymore. We're not going to redeem it in gold or dollars. Its own international monetary system was sacrificed on the altar of continued domestic inflation. One sort of point... Benjamin Anderson, in his book, Economics and Public Welfare, gives a little poignant little story of the head of the Dutch Central Bank, I forget his name, who calls up the Montague Norman about a day before, or the Treasury, the British Treasury, I forget which, about a day before Britain goes off the gold standard. It's very secret, of course. You don't go off the gold standard except in deepest secrecy. He calls up and says, look, fellas, you owe me a lot of money and so forth. I've been a great friend of yours, and please tell me if you intend to go off the gold standard, otherwise, then you'll pull out. Give me this one little break. And he said, don't worry, we'll never go off the gold standard, never, never. We're your old friend, we can assure you of this. And the next day, they go off the gold standard. This is typical. I mean, as bad as governments are in general, they're really at their worst and they're scurviest on the international monetary devaluation, et cetera, front. They lie constantly. They double deal, et cetera, on a grand scale. It's all done for the public interest, don't worry, folks. The European monetary system was thereby broken up into separate and even warring currency blocks. And one of the things that Karen was asking yesterday about the Friedmanite freely fluctuating exchange rate system. And one of the problems, I don't want to go into the economic theoretical critique of this, but one of the practical political problems of this thing is that it will never happen in a million years. You'll never have a situation where every government is given total power over its fiat currency, over its own banks and its own currency, and then stay back and permit their currency, their precious currency, to fluctuate freely. It'll never happen. So what you have is, if this starts happening, you very quickly have currency blocks, exchange controls, bilateral deals, and all the monstrous stuff that we had in the 30s, which is the consequence of everybody going off the gold standard. We have competing devaluations where you try to devaluate your currency a little bit, so get your export, you subsidize your exports, and the other guy does the other thing, and then you have your, you know, you have exchange controls, and fantastic mess develops. The European monetary system is thereby broken up into separate and even warring currency blocks, replete with fluctuating exchange rates, exchange control, and trade restrictions. The major countries follow Britain off the gold standard, with the exception of Belgium, Holland, France, Italy, Switzerland, and the United States. Currency blocks form with the British Empire, forming a sterling block, with parities mutually fixed in relation to the pound. So they're all, they're floating, but they're fixed in relation to each other, something like the common market we're doing now. It's particularly ironic that one of the earliest effects of Britain's going off gold was of the overvalued pound, which Britain had assisted, you know, and had put everybody else through the ringer to keep at 486. Now when they got off the gold standard, now the pound was free to fluctuate, pound shot right down to its genuine economic value at approximately $3.40 to the pound. So after all this headache they imposed on the world, when they allow the pound to float, goes right down. And so Britain's grand experiment of returning to a form of gold at an overvalued par had ended in disaster for herself as well as for the rest of the world. In the last weeks of the Hoover administration, a desperate attempt was made by the United States to restore an international monetary system. This time the offer was made to Britain to return to the gold standard at the current, eminently more sensible par, that means 380, 350, 340, in exchange for a substantial reduction of the British war debt. No longer would Britain be forced by overvaluation to be in a chronic state of depression of its export industry. See, by this time, the British had realized they did something wrong back there, and it's better to have the British pound low and stimulate their exports. This is the Marxists call education through struggle. Learning through the struggle. No longer would Britain be forced by overvaluation to be in a chronic state of depression of its export industries. But Britain now had the nationalist bit in its teeth and it insisted on outright reflation of prices back to the pre-depression 1929 levels. Now we have this reflation bit. It had become increasingly clear that the powerful price stabilizationists, the Fisher, Cummins, other group, were interested not so much in stabilization as in high prices. And now they would only be satisfied with an inflationary return to the 1929 levels. Britain's rejection of the American offer proved to be fatal for any hopes of international monetary stability. The world's monetary fate finally rested with the United States, the major gold country, standard country still remaining. Federal Reserve attempts to inflate the money supply and to lower interest rates during the Depression further weakened confidence in the dollar, and gold outflows combined with runs and failures of the banks to put increasing pressure on the American banking system. See, Hoover tried desperately to inflate. Milton Friedman, in his book, Monetary History of the United States, denounces Hoover for lowering the money supply and from 1929 to 33, and thereby precipitating a depression, supposedly. Actually, Hoover is trying his damnedest to increase the money supply. He's trying everything possible. Buying the Federal Reserve is buying securities like mad. They were pushing down interest rates. The problem was that the depression had set in, and the confidence was weakened, and the public was cashing in their money. They're cashing in their bank accounts, so getting hard cash and even gold, and gold was redemption was being demanded from abroad, etc. So all this overweighed the desperate attempts by Hoover to inflate. Finally, during the interregnum between the Hoover and Roosevelt administrations, the nation's banks began to collapse in earnest. The general bank collapse meant that the banking system, always unsound and incapable of paying more than a fraction of its liabilities on demand, could only go in either of two opposite directions. So I'm talking about this big opportunity worked in. A truly laissez-faire policy would have allowed the failing banks to collapse and thereby to engage in a swift, sharp, surgical operation. It would have transformed the nation's monetary system from an unsound inflationary one to a truly hard and stable currency. The other poll was for the government to declare massive bank holidays, i.e. to relieve the banks of the obligation to pay off their debts, which they had done, of course, in every previous depression every previous financial crisis from 1814 on, and then move on to the repudiation of the gold standard and its replacement by inflated fiat paper issued by the government. It is important to realize that neither the Hoover nor the Roosevelt administrations had any intention of taking the first route, the sharp surgical operation back to hard money routes. While there was a considerable split on whether or not to stay on the gold standard, no one endorsed the rigorous laissez-faire route. One thing is that even though Hoover, of course, was still in favor of keeping on the gold standard, his Secretary of Treasury, Ogden Mills, and his Undersecretary, Arthur Ballantyne, by the time March 33 came around, they were in favor of going off the gold standard. They were anticipating the Roosevelt policy. The new Roosevelt administration was now faced with a choice of retaining or going off the gold standard. While almost everyone supported the temporary bank holidays, even Anderson and Willis, these people said, well, we have to save the banks. That's, you know, it's a key thing. Might have been helpful along with their Chase Bank connections, I suppose. While almost everyone supported temporary bank holidays, there was a severe split on the longer-run question of the monetary standard. While the bulk of the nation's academic economists stood staunchly behind the gold standard, it's hard to imagine now, but they did. It was, I think, 5,000 economists or 1,200 or something wrote a big letter, a big public statement endorsing, you know, sticking in the gold standard. The indefatigable Irving Fisher redoubled his agitation for inflation, spurred onward by his personal desire to reinflate stock prices. Since the Stable Money Association had been supposedly dedicated to price stabilization, that was Fisher's group, and what Fisher and the inflationists wanted now was a drastic raising of prices, the association liquidated its assets and changed its name. You know, so it disappeared, got a new name. In other words, instead of the Stable Money Association, which since 1911 been calling for stabilizing prices, now they dropped the name. They form a new name called the Committee for the Nation to Rebuild Prices and Purchasing Power. This is, of course, shortened by everybody, including themselves, to the Committee for the Nation. It's a very interesting group, the Committee for the Nation. The Committee for the Nation, founded in January 1933, stood squarely for, quote, reflation, unquote, of prices back to the pre-1929 levels. Stabilization of the price level was to proceed only after that point had been achieved. The Committee for the Nation, which was to prove crucially influential on Roosevelt's decision, was composed largely of prominent businessmen. In other words, you had Fisher and Warren and Pearson as another thing, but as the sort of stable, as the mass base of the group, we had a very prominent businessman involved in it. The committee was originated by Vincent Bendix, president of Bendix Aviation, and General Robert E. Wood, head of Sears Roebuck and Company. They were soon joined in the fall of 1932 by Frank Vanderlip, long close to Fisher, and formerly president of the National City Bank of New York, by James H. Rand, Jr., Remington Rand, and by Magnus W. Alexander, head of the National Industrial Conference Board. Other members of the Committee for the Nation included Fred H. Sexsauer, president of the Dairymen's League Cooperative Association, Frederick H. Frazier, chairman of the board of the General Baking Company, automobile magnate E.L. Cord, the Cord car, Lessing J. Rosenwald, chairman of Sears Roebuck, Samuel S. Fells of Fells & Company, who was also a big corporate liberal, Fells Naphtha, I guess that's right. Philip K. Wrigley, president of William Wrigley Company, you know, Wrigley Chewing Gum, John Henry Hammond, chairman of the board of Bangor and Aroostook Railroad, Edward A. O'Neill, head of the American Farm Bureau Federation, L.J. Tabor, head of the National Grange, F.R. Wurlitzer, vice president Rudolph Wurlitzer Manufacturing Company, William J. McAveeny, president of Hudson Motor Company, that's the old Coffin connection, somehow Hudson's always deeply involved in the state apparatus, Frankie Gannett of the Gannett Newspapers, and Indiana banker William A. Wirt. Interestingly enough, yeah. Oh, yeah? No kidding. That's right, Gannett Papers over there, too. Yeah. Great. Interestingly enough, this same group of highly conservative industrialists was later to become the Committee for Constitutional Government, the major anti-New Deal propaganda group of the late 30s and 40s. When I was growing up in the movement, so to speak, Committee for Constitutional Government was the big mass right-wing, you know, anti-New Deal organization. They would send out millions of teeny leaflets of the so-called opinion mongers across the country. As interesting as the only time they were ever influential was the one time they were in favor of the government, you know, in favor of the New Deal, and as soon as they were against the New Deal, they lose influence. Yet this committee was the major proponent of the inflationist policy of the early New Deal and reflating and abandoning the gold standard. Also associated with the Committee for the Nation was another leading influence of Franklin Roosevelt's decision, agricultural economist George F. Warren of Cornell, who, along with his colleague Frank A. Pearson, was the inspiration for the reflationist Roosevelt program of continually raising the buying price of gold. A very funny thing happened. In the 1954 recession, I think it was, the Committee for the Nation had become the Committee for Constitutional Government, but their hearts still lay in this raising the price of gold policy. I mean, down deep, under all the free market rhetoric and all that, still, you know, lay this hardcore of raising the price of gold. And they imported Colin Clark to speak to them about how to solve the 1954 recession. And I happened to be at this dinner. It was one of my first dinner functions in the movement. And the conservative, you know, widely conservative movement. And Colin Clark doesn't know who these people are. Colin Clark is a very distinguished English economist, extremely conservative, fanatically pro-population, which might be connected with very conservative Catholic views, and also very Keynesian. He was in favor of the free market and everything, but a very, very Keynesian. Okay, so he gives a speech on the 54 recession, and the first has it's a weird speech. The first is very distinguished, of course, cultured Oxford type, as all these Englishmen are, and he gives this whole, he gives the first half of his speech. As I say, he doesn't know who these people are. He gives the first half of his Committee for the Nation type group. First half of the speech is attacking the state. The state is evil, the state is a parasite, and all the rest of the same stuff I've been saying here. And the last half of the thing is completely shifts around. He calls for a $50 billion deficit immediately. He says, there's only one way to cure this recession. I've studied this whole American recession. The only way to cure is an immediate, massive, fantastic deficit to lift the economy up. So that's because he's extreme right-wing Keynesian. All right, so that comes the question period, comments. Every one of these guys sitting around the table, these old banker types, and these old guys, what was the name of the big, Norman Lombard and these other characters from the, and Ambrose Bunker and all these guys, and each one of them starts giving this big reflating gold, reflating gold thing. A quart clock, never heard this stuff, you know, it's not part of the academic mainstream. and the guys, and one of these guys is shaking his finger at Clark's face and saying, "You say the price of gold," and Clark said, "Well, I don't see how the price of gold is very important." And the guy is shaking his finger at Clark's face saying, "Supposing we raise the price of gold at $20,000 an ounce, wouldn't that have an effect on them?" the committee for the Nation at first included several hundred industrial and agricultural leaders, and within a year its membership reached over 2,000. Its recommendations, beginning with going off gold and embargoing gold exports, and continuing through devaluing the dollar and raising the price of gold, were fairly closely followed by the Roosevelt administration. For his part, Irving Fisher, in response to a request for advice by President-elect Roosevelt, asking Fisher for advice, it's a rum thing to do, boy. Anyway, had strongly urged at the end of February a frankly inflationist policy of reflation, devaluation, leaving the gold standard without delay, getting off the gold standard without delay. By April 19, 1933, when Roosevelt had cast a die for this policy, Fisher exulted in one of his letters, quote, "Now I am sure, as far as we ever can be sure of anything, that we're going to snap out of this depression fast." Yes, sir, it was a pretty good prediction. "I am now one of the happiest men in the world." In the same letter to his wife, an heiress of the substantial Hazard family fortune, Fisher added, quote, "My next big job is to raise money for ourselves. Probably we'll have to go to sister again," and that's his wife's sister, Caroline. I mean, he's multing of these millions. "I have defaulted payments the last few weeks because I did not think it was fair to ask sister for money when there's a real chance I could ever pay it back. I mean, if FDR had followed Glass," Carter Glass of Virginia was being influenced by H. Parker Willis, the hard money man, "if FDR had followed Glass, we would have been pretty surely ruined." That's we, meaning he and his wife and his sister and sister-in-law. "So would Allied Chemical, in which much of his family's fortune was invested, his wife's family fortune was invested, and the U.S. government. Now I can go to sister with a clean conscience." I don't know who Allied Chemical is linked up here in the Morgan Rockefeller thing. I've tossed it open to the question period. Anybody who knows about that. If Irving Fisher's interest was personal as well as political, as well as ideological, economic interests also underlay the concern of the Committee for the Nation. The farm groups wanted farm prices driven up, including farm export prices, which necessarily increase in terms of other currencies whenever currencies devalue. As for the rest of the committee and the other inflationists, Herbert Feist notes, I'm not a great fan of Herbert Feist, but in this case I will use the quote, you know, you have the quote scripture from the devil or whatever. Herbert Feist notes, quote, "By the spring of 1933, diverse organizations and groups were crying aloud for some kind of monetary inflation or devaluation or both. Most effective probably was the Committee for the Nation. Among its members were prominent merchants, such as the head of Sears Roebuck, some journalists, some Wall Street operators, and some foreign exchange speculators. Their purpose was to get the United States off the gold standard and to bring about the devaluation of the dollar, from which they would profit, either as speculators in foreign exchange or as businessmen. Another group, more conservative, who stood to gain by devaluation, were those who had already exported gold or otherwise acquired liquid deposits in foreign banks. They conceived that they were merely protecting the value of their capital. Then there were the exporters, especially of farm products, who had been at a disadvantage ever since Great Britain had gone off the gold standard, and the value of sterling had fallen much below its previous parity with the dollar." All these guys say, "Oh, no, Britain's devalued. We got to devalue to match Britain, spur our exports. Also advocating and endorsing the decision to inflate and leave the gold standard was such conservative bankers as James P. Warburg of Kuhn Loebelman Company, one of Roosevelt's leading monetary advisors, former vice president and Chicago banker Charles G. Dawes, Melvin A. Traylor, president of the First National Bank of Chicago, Frank Oldshaw of the International Banking House of Lazare Frères, and Russell C. Leffingwell, partner of J.P. Morgan & Company. Leffingwell told Roosevelt that his action, quote, was vitally necessary and most important of all the helpful things you have done, unquote. Morgan coming in directly there. Morgan himself hailed Roosevelt's decision to leave the gold standard. Note how this contrasts with the usual, you know, sort of beauty and thing that conservative bankers always favor the gold standard. So Morgan writes to Roosevelt. Morgan issues this thing to the New York Times press release. I welcome the reported action of the President and the Secretary of the Treasury in placing an embargo on gold exports. It has become evident that the effort to maintain the exchange value of the dollar at a premium as against depreciated foreign currencies was having a deflationary effect upon an already severely deflated American prices and wages and employment. It seems to me clear that the way out of the depression is to combat and overcome the deflationary forces. Therefore, I regard the action now taken as being the best possible course under the circumstances. J.P. Morgan. Other prominent advocates of going off the gold standard were publishers J. David Stern and William Randolph Hearst, financier James H.R. Cromwell, the great Sullivan Cromwell Banking House, and Dean Wallace Dunham of the Harvard Business School. Dunham is one of the big corporatist ideologues in this whole thing. During the 1931-32, when the Swope Plan comes in, Dunham says, well, you know, some really good things about the Soviet Union, even though he's not really a commie at the heart of business, Harvard Business School. They have a five-year plan, they plan industry. We should follow this. Conservative Republican senators such as David A. Reed of Pennsylvania and minority leader Charles O. McNary of Oregon also approved the decision, and Senator Arthur Vandenberg, Republican of Michigan, happily declared that Americans could now compete in the export trade, quote, for the first time in many, many months. Vandenberg concluded that, abandonment of the dollar externally may prove to be a complete answer to our problem so far as the currency factor is concerned. Typical badly written quote by Vandenberg. Amidst this chorus of approval from leading financiers and industrialists, there was still determined opposition to going off gold. Aside from the bulk of the nation's economists, the lead in opposition was again taken by two economists with close ties to the banking community who had been major opponents of a strong Morgan policy during the 1920s, Benjamin M. Anderson of the Rockefeller-oriented Chase National Bank, and Dr. H. Parker Willis, editor of the Journal of Commerce and chief advisor to Senator Carter Glass, who had been Secretary of Treasury under Wilson. The Chamber of Commerce of the United States also vigorously attacked the abandonment of gold as well as price level stabilization, and Chamber of Commerce of New York State also called for prompt return to gold. From the financial community, leading opponents of Roosevelt's decision were Winthrop W. Aldrich, Rockefeller kinsman and head of the Chase National Bank, and Roosevelt's budget director, Lewis W. Douglas of the Arizona mining family, who was related to the J. Henry Schroeder International Bankers and was eventually to become head of Mutual Life Insurance Company and ambassador to England. Douglas fought valiantly but in vain within the administration against going off gold and against the remainder of the New Deal program. He later leaves the administration, writes a blistering book attacking the New Deal for the liberal tradition. By the end of April 1933, the United States was clearly off the gold standard, and the dollar quickly began to depreciate relative to gold and the gold standard currencies. Britain, which a few weeks earlier had loftily rejected the idea of international stabilization, had now become frightened. After all, we're devaluing now. You know, their exports are being hurt. You know, do something about this. currency blocks and a depreciating pound away British exports was one thing. Depreciation of the dollar to spur American exports and injure British exports was quite another. The British had the presumption to scold the United States for going off gold. That was really cute. I mean, here they go off gold, we go off gold 2 years later, and they're griping. They now rested their final hope for a restored international monetary system on the World Economic Conference scheduled for London in June 1933. Well, I think that's a good note to stop, sort of a teaser for tomorrow night. We'll go on to the World Economic Conference and the New Deal.